Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to Free Exchange. I'm Oliver Wiseman, editor of CapEx and host of Free Exchange. For our final podcast of the year, we're going to do something a little different. Rather than our usual format, I'll be looking back on 2018 with a group of CapEx contributors. Who had a bad year? Who had a good year? What were the big ideas behind the year's news? We'll be asking these questions and more by handing out our end-of-year awards. Some of them, I should point out, are less serious than others. I hope you enjoy the show.
Okay, hello and welcome to Free Exchange. I'm here with John Ashmore, Deputy Editor of CapEx, Alan Lockie from Demos, and Madeline Grant of the IEA. All CapEx contributors. I'm, of course, Oliver Wiseman, editor of CapEx. And we're here to do an end-of-year podcast special in which we hand out awards, some more coveted than others, to the biggest winners and losers in what has been a fairly busy political year. So let's go straight into the first category, which is biggest winner. And we're going to start with Madeline. Madeline, who's your nomination?
I think this is going to be very unpopular, but I've actually gone for the Prime Minister. Now, I should clarify by saying that I vehemently disagree with the direction the PM is taking things at the moment. But I do think that she has to be given some, albeit grudging, credit for having managed to hold on to her position in the face of almost unanimous opposition. Now, I think biggest winner does not have to necessarily be someone that we support or think is good. That's not how I've chosen to interpret these questions. But the fact that, you know, as I say, unanimous opposition, everyone's predictions, and I think the fact that in the face of all of this she is still here does justify the title of biggest winner, however grudgingly.
Okay, the Prime Minister, starting big. What we'll do is we'll lay out our cases for our people and then we'll go into... We can duke it out afterwards. So, Alan, who, what have you picked?
Well, I'm very, very... saying it's not necessarily popular, but I very, very nearly plumped for the Prime Minister as well, because I think by all... if this was a fair era of politics, she would be the biggest winner now, and she would be standing in front of Parliament, who had signed off a deal, which is quite clearly the only deal that emerges from the referendum result, in my opinion. As it is, she has been defeated by my biggest winner, which is an array of fantastical unicorns, some from the Labour Party, some from the Conservative Party. Most of all, are all predicated on a fantasy negotiation, renegotiation, which is not on the table, and there is no time for it. And this is where the balance of parliamentary opinion seems to be. So rather than a kind of moment to genuinely bring the country together, along a compromise of, you know, the 52 and the 48%, in a way that is more appropriate for a direct democracy election than a representative one. The Prime Minister has rather been defeated. She should be the biggest winner, but she's been defeated by just utter nonsense, as far as I can see, from Parliament.
Okay, John, you're going to take us overseas for your one and get outside the Westminster bubble. Who are you picking?
Yeah, I toyed with a few different ones. Jair Bolsonaro obviously won one of the biggest elections of the year in Brazil, not a country we cover all that often in the British media. But I've gone for my main man, Vladimir Putin, who romped home with a quite frankly astonishing 77% of the popular vote. His best ever performance in a, what I can only assume were free and fair elections in the Russian Federation. If you look back at the year 2000, for instance, he got a mere 53% of the vote against a fake communist candidate. And last time, I think he only got 63. But also, I mean, jokes aside, he does just continue to act with complete impunity and take the piss. I mean, anyone who watched the two, sports medication salesmen on their return from Salisbury can tell that is a country that is basically just trolling the rest of the world and having a bit of fun doing it.
And I think that's more the Perrier Awards that they...
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think we're all being too cynical. I think we've all been to... We've all enjoyed a good trip to a good cathedral. And Salisbury is a fantastic cathedral.
Yeah.
The best thing about that is they didn't actually go to the cathedral. No, I shouldn't make light of what is basically a terrorist attack. But yeah, I mean, he continues to... he continues to win in everywhere, really. Like, he just... The Russians are still in Syria, basically dictating what Assad does. They're palling around with the Iranians. They're still in eastern Ukraine. Nothing's really happening there. Russian oligarchs are still exporting Ukrainian coal on the black market, which is kind of part of that war that's not really discussed that much. So, yeah, I think Putin will be quite pleased with his work in 2018.
Okay, so I'm going to go international as well, and I'm going to say... mine's not a specific person, but it's very broadly America's democratic socialists, or let's just say the left wing of the Democratic Party. I know those two things aren't the same, but I think the midterms this year were sort of a mixed bag and very complicated in lots of ways, but it's clearly the case now that with a presidential election campaign sort of all too close, the left wing of the Democratic Party feels like it's in the ascendancy, and it feels like, a lot gets written about the likes of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's one of these figureheads of this movement, but it just feels like the Democrats are going to pick rather than try and win the center of American politics against Donald Trump, they're sort of going to veer off in their own direction. And I think that is bad news for America, obviously. And I think that's going to, in terms of what happened this year, that's going to really define politics globally in the next couple of years. I think the direction of the Democratic Party is quite important. So there are nominations. Anyone just grossly disagree with anyone else here?
Okay, Ollie, I don't grossly disagree with yours. I don't follow American politics as closely as I should. But from what I understood, even if people like Ocasio-Cortez have these huge followings, my understanding is that the Democrats who flipped seats, the majority were the moderate Democrats. Mm. So perhaps that's not an accurate reflection of people's voting habits. Maybe it's a more accurate reflection of the kind of the dominant narrative in the Twitter conversation.
I would go along with that. I would also suggest, with one eyebrow raised, really, that if you do manage to pull off the fastest selling autobiography of all time at this stage in the cycle, and you're not a democratic socialist, that is at least interesting. And I think that if that candidate decided to stand, she would absolutely trounce all of the candidates, including any candidate from that wing of the Democratic Party.
But don't you think it's interesting the way that the right are completely obsessed with the democratic socialists? So even if they may be disproportionately obsessed with them, they often tend to go after them for crazy reasons. So they attack Ocasio-Cortez for wearing an expensive suit on her first day in Congress, which...
That obviously is my primary objection.
It's quite a big day. I think we probably all wear our best suit for that day, but it's really incredibly... incredibly trivial, and they should be going after them on, how does this... A bit like the CPS did, to give fellow think tanks some credit, actually cost the opposition's policies.
Right. That's always kind of a good thing. Start.
I think it's a bit of a meme in American politics is that Democrats are actually champagne socialists, and they're all actually living the high life and talking down to ordinary Americans.
I'm sort of sensing that I'm not going to win everyone round of mine, but I'm not going to let John's claim that Vladimir Putin's had a good year go unchecked before we move on, because I think
he won
that
big.
I think that as unlike in 2016 and maybe 2017, Russia with Putin at the head was this scary power secretly pulling the strings on whether it's the Brexit referendum or the presidential election. This is the story we're told. I'm not saying I sign up to it. But, you know, this omnipotent autocrat was pulling all the strings. I think what we've seen in 2018, apart from his handsome presidential election win, is we've seen an actually very fallible Russia, a Russia that makes lots of mistakes, looks amateurish, and looks kind of, you know, doesn't actually compare very well to the rest of the world. So I think, if anything, it's sort of been a sort of year of overreach for Putin and embarrassment. He wouldn't have wanted, he didn't want those murderers to be on Russia Today explaining they were on a tourist trip to Salisbury, funny as that was. So I just think he's had a bad, in fact, I think he's one of the biggest losers of the year, not one of the biggest winners, but...
I think there's an interesting way of looking at this, which maybe we should on a podcast called Free Exchange, which is to look at it as kind of investors and see who has had a better year-on-year return. Mm-hmm. For me, Vladimir Putin's 2018 is, as Ollie said, not as good as his 2017. Brexit unicorns and Brexit kind of fantastical cakeism, I don't know if it's changed that much.
I think it has. I'm quite taken with the Brexit unicorns. Or the purveyor, the sort of the riders of the unicorns have done pretty well, even if they didn't win the confidence vote. The fact that, like, Jacob Rees-Mogg is now a household name, to me, is just utterly bizarre.
Well, I think Jacob's preference for the settlement and the future relationship is one of the non-unicorn options, actually. I mean, that is something that is very, very real.
You mean in the sense that he's more explicit about the trade-offs?
Well, no, I think no deal is not a unicorn. May deal is not a unicorn, and I think second referendum is unicornish, but it is a thing that could, in theory, happen.
So I might tweak your answer and say that the hard Brexiteers have had a good year.
But I think
because we're getting close to there.
But you're talking about Labour. You're talking about Labour too on Brexit.
Labour absolutely. Yeah. Anyone who is suggesting that there is a way to renegotiate the deal. So I mean, I think much though I have some sympathy for the EEA position, I think I include the likes of Nick Bowles in this. It's just not an option.
My only problem with your nomination, and I think you make lots of good points, but my only problem, sort of serious problem with it, is you don't actually, for it to be true that the Brexit unicorns has had a good year, you would have to say that the peddlers of these theories were in a stronger position as a result of their policy on Brexit. I don't think you can say that about the Labour Party or Boris Johnson, for example, or Nick Bowles, if we can talk about, but you know, I mean, these are not things that are.
No, I agree,
and are catching on.
I agree, and I was kind of moving on the sort of year by year analysis to swinging behind Madeleine, really, because however whatever you feel about Theresa May's 2018, it was certainly better than a 2017.
Yeah, I think if we're measuring on a kind of relative rather than absolute scale, I think Theresa May absolutely takes this one.
Yeah, I think you could. I mean, I guess the point about the Prime Minister would be the damage was all done in 2017.
Yeah,
and so from then to now, has she?
She's done better than expected.
Yeah,
definitely give her that.
So we find ourselves, I think, in the astonishing position of giving CapEx's winner of the year to a prime
a confidence vote. That's
to a prime minister who faces a complete doom in January and has scraped through a confidence vote among her MPs. But congratulations, Theresa May, you are our winner of the year.
Gareth Southgate, sorry.
Yeah, I mean, he definitely didn't win.
It's the equivalent of being in the Grand National, everyone else's horse kind of gets fully knocked over, and Theresa May's just about hobbles over the line and thereby
with
wins
the jockey
it.
Being sort of dragged along.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay, so from winner to loser, I'll get the big ones out of the way first. So, why don't we start with John this time? John, who is your biggest loser?
Well, actually, follows neatly on from our last bit. I just put the Conservative Party, because they have, I mean, they're at each other's throats in a way. It was kind of predictable. I suppose you could imagine some sort of civil war. But they did a fairly okay job immediately after the referendum of being fairly civil. But now it's really hell's broken loose. And I think there are kind of potentially... Maybe existential problems is overstating it, but there would be, if you went for no deal, there are already Tories saying they won't run as Tories. And if, imagine there was a general election, I know there are going to be Eurosceptic MPs who are going to consider not running for a Conservative Party, running on a ticket that would be pro a deal that they hate. So I think real issues for them, they haven't exactly, you know, shot the Europe fox yet.
And if they go with no deal, then they're also going to lose people like Nick Bowles and Anna Soubry on the other
Indeed.
Side. So
yeah. It's whack-a-mole for them.
Okay, so John says the divided Conservative Party. Madeleine, who's your biggest loser?
I've gone for Emmanuel Macron, I guess, to get away from the bubble. Well, of course, Macron, again, has suffered, I think, from the opposite of what Theresa May had, which was incredibly high expectations, which have perhaps unreasonably high expectations, which have we've seen kind of crumble into ashes over the last 12 months. There's been over a month of protests now, I think, from the Gilets Jaunes, who are creating all sorts of problems for him. He's at historic low ratings in the polls. And it's not just the situation that he's in, I think, makes him the biggest loser of 2018, but also the incredibly incompetent and short-sighted way in which he's handled these problems. So, for example, when faced with a great deal of resentment from working-class people who feel marginalised and feel the high living costs and so on, he does a very kind of Marie Antoinette-like speech in the Élysée Palace in a room that's kind of gold-plated as far as the eye can see. And it's not really... It seems that he's suffering both from misjudgment but also a complete lack of self-awareness, which I think probably looks set to create further problems down the line.
Yeah.
Okay, Alan, you have gone for a British politician. Who is it?
Well, I felt like I should have gone for Steve Baker just because he's a slightly more comic figure in my estimation. But I've gone for the obvious choice to represent the ERG, really, which is Boris Johnson. And, the start of 2018, Boris Johnson is Foreign Secretary. He's in pole position, I would have thought, and I defer to the people around the table, but he's in pole position, really, as the Brexiteers candidate du jour if there is a leadership election. And he finds himself at the end of 2018 not necessarily being able to supplant David Davis. I mean, this is quite the fall from grace, but it's more than that, really, because he fundamentally has not been able to change any perceptions that are abroad about his character as a politician in about 2 or 3 years, really. He hasn't used the opportunity of government to suggest that he can be serious and statesmanlike. He hasn't used the critique that he is divisive, which emerged out of the referendum, to kind of demonstrate. He hasn't been able to move on from the perception that he would divide the country if he was prime minister. And he hasn't really been able to come up with a single practical idea for the Brexit that he supposedly wants. He tends to sort of provide an analysis from the pages of the Daily Telegraph, very well remunerated, I'm sure, but the analysis is basically we just need to believe in ourselves a little bit more. And I think that is just so out of keeping for what he as a politician needs to do to change the country's perception of himself. So he's in no man's land, really, as we look at the end of the year.
Okay, so we've had the Conservative Party, Macron, Boris Johnson. I'm going to go overseas again, and I'm plumping for Xi Jinping, because I think
the most powerful man in the world.
Yeah, but bear with me. I think one of the stories of 2018, Xi is in here to represent the story, is at least in the West, the slight shift in thinking in terms of China, the rise of China being completely inevitable and unstoppable force that needs to mean we could question all sorts of our own political assumptions and so on, to a phenomenon which is looking like it has lots of problems. The Belt and Road Initiative, for instance, has kind of been a classic case of overreach. There's been huge problems with the borrowing in that. The Chinese government is looking quite amateurish in the way it's dealing with lots of other governments. And so I just think there's this idea, this unquestionable thing that is like China knows what they're doing. We are entering the Chinese century and kind of that's what's going to happen. Is looking less and less certain to me and looking more and more contested. I mean, that's not to mention, by the way, if this was a sort of what we thought of them and their beliefs rather than how good a year they had. It has been the year in which we've learnt about basically concentration labour camps for the Uyghur scary social credit system. And, you know, this is a totalitarian government, and it looks like it falls short in all the ways totalitarian governments always do in terms of not necessarily being sustainable in the long run, even if Xi is sort of doubling down on his approach. So I agree, it sort of seems an unlikely one given how powerful a man I'm talking about, but I just think that the sort of the shine has come off the idea of China as this as the future. So that is a fairly somber note to
yeah, I agree with those criticisms, but I don't know if there's really been a kind of enough crystal moments of him failing,
right,
rather than it's like more visible parts of a process. So Macron, I think, has the most like, oh my god, look what's going on.
I mean, I'd love to defend Emmanuel as a sort of centrist, but he has had a phenomenally bad year, and I don't know, I have to take a slightly depressing tone on China, really. I think if you look at some of the emergent technologies of the next phase of capitalism, such as artificial intelligence, there is a real sense that the illiberalism of China is giving them an edge, actually, in an economic arms race. I don't have a sense of confidence in the, you know, maybe China has taken a few missteps this year, and there are certainly some worrying signs for all of us, really, about the direction that their economy is going. But there's no sense, the corollary to that is there's no sense of a confidence that the West enjoyed in the 80s, where, you know, liberalism, free markets, free speech is part of how we win against a geopolitical war. It still feels like we're very much on a sort of defensive crouch. And, I don't share your confidence.
Okay. Well, give it a few years. Okay, maybe I'll concede defeat on China, but Alan, I'm going to push back on Boris a bit, because I think
he could still be prime minister.
Exactly. I mean, I think that
he's the most popular in opinion polls of all.
He's
the most.
He remains the most popular conservative,
and also the most hated as well. Though,
yes, but kind of I think that the idea that he's, you know, I think it's a tricky one, because none of these nominees have sort of totally screwed things up for themselves irreparably, I would say, but I do think, in terms of the position they find themselves in at the end of the year, I don't, for all the drama, I don't know if Boris is actually, you know, who liked Boris at the beginning of the year and now doesn't like him. I don't know if there are many people like that. For example, if you're thinking about a popularity contest.
Yeah, that's
a lot more of his colleagues, unfortunately, which is his
potentially,
problem.
Yeah.
It's kind of the same with the Tories, actually, because the polls are about the same.
But there was that absolutely ludicrous outburst in the last few weeks where people were talking about Boris as Aslan, you know, returning to Narnia to rid the Conservative Party of Jadis / Theresa May. You know, there is this ridiculous language being used about him still. It's almost kind of hero worshipping. Which does suggest that there are still people who are really strongly putting all their hopes on Boris.
I think there might be a fifth candidate we can all get behind, which is JC. Because he's had a bit of a shocker of a year. Like, any other leader of the opposition would be miles ahead in the polls, and he's like struggling with basic parliamentary process and then managing to get himself caught up in like ridiculous.
Yeah. I wonder if he doesn't sort of fall into the same category as Boris, in the sense that like it won't necessarily proved to matter that much, and he can just sort of wait it out and leave your nominee, the Conservative Party.
Yeah, I mean, any argument that applies to the Conservative Party.
Is anyone winning?
It's a year of stalemate, really, in terms of winners and losers.
I think John makes a really strong point about Corbyn, because, again, I think if we're measuring things sort of relatively, he started the year with very high expectation, and so in that time we've seen endless opportunities for him to score points, and endless, again, talking about bin collections and allotments and stuff. And there's also, we've had Labour Live, which I don't know how indicative that was of something bigger, but it did in itself kind of suggest that a bit of the sort of Glastonbury.
This was the Labour Festival that was
there. Yes,
that was.
I've forgotten.
It was
in Tottenham as well.
I think it was this summer. And if you think what happened last summer, or summer 2017, when Jeremy Corbyn was headlining the pyramid stage at Glastonbury, you'd think that getting some left-wing young people to come to a festival in a kind of edgy bit of London, where there's some, you know, with Jeremy Corbyn, that would have seemed like a no-brainer. But
I mean, they did book the magic numbers as headline.
I think we forgot about Madeleine's nominee, which is Macron, and I think that's the strong, in my book, he's had a terrible year.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, if you think about start to finish, the sort of saviour of liberalism to Jupiter, it's interesting because he may yet pull through. I mean, it's early days of a French presidency. It's hard to know, but by no reasonable standard has he had anything other than a really bad year.
I think he's almost been hoisted by his own petard to an extent. Firstly, because people had incredibly high expectations, and people from all sides of the political compass were reading what they wanted to see in Macron. So, for example, free marketeers were saying, oh, look, you know, economic liberalism is back on the agenda. People who don't like Brexit were saying, look, the populist wave is, you know, also at an end. And I think people didn't really look so much at Macron. They just turned him into a kind of figurehead for what they wanted. Mm. And now the same thing is happening, only it's being applied to the Gilets Jaunes themselves, yeah. Because free marketeers are now saying, oh, they want low taxes, they must be sound like us. Working class people are saying, oh, look, they're rising up against... left-wing people are saying, oh, look, working class people are rising up against neoliberalism. So exactly the same process is happening, only it's been reversed on Macron.
I'm fully behind that. Any objections to Macron as the...
Not at all.
Alan looks like he's unclear. He's unsure.
No, it's just difficult. It's difficult to... I mean, I think all these people, with the exception of Xi, have had a pretty bad year.
So it's a split decision, but I'm afraid, 3-1. So we are going to say Emmanuel Macron is the biggest loser of 2018. So that brings us on to word of the year. In this category, we've actually got two people going for the same word. So we can sort of both just get your word and agree on that. But let's start with John. John, what's your word of the year?
My word of the year is gamma.
Explain to CapEx. Not every CapEx reader will necessarily know what the word means, other than
a certain type of puce-faced, angry, middle-aged white man. I'd say it's me in about 20 years. it's epitomised by a screen grab of various people in the audience for question time, which I really encourage you to look up. I think it's just a word I see around a lot, and it's completely entered the political lexicon in quite a short time, and it's one of those words that people just immediately knew exactly what you meant. And I find it quite funny when, like, people get up on their high horse about it, be like, this is racist.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, I think the thing that's so very 2018 about gammon is it gets invented as this, like, zeitgeisty political word, which is a bit silly, but whatever. And then we have to have this tedious row about whether it's racist or whether it's moronic, like, culture war in which you're like team gammon
it might be a bit of a stretch to say that it's racist to say that white men sometimes have rosy cheeks and look a bit pink-faced, but it's a super super snobby word, and it tends to be used in an extremely snobby and unpleasant derogatory way to dismiss Brexiteers largely. So I think, like, it's entered the political compass, and I don't think it's actually in terms of the word of the year, I actually wouldn't give it, because I think in terms of the power of the word, it doesn't achieve its objectives, because it pisses off far more people than it would ever win round.
I think that is its objective. I mean, that's the Steve Bannon approach to politics, which is choose your enemies and don't worry about anything else. But in terms of
you know, we live in a fractured world. People are trying to gain support for Remain or Leave or, you know, No Deal or second referendum. The word gammon is crystallising support, I would imagine, amongst the Brexiteers, which is not what the people using it would want to see.
I just put it there because I thought it was funny.
Perfectly reasonable ground.
It has cut through. I mean, for my sins, I go on weird sort of Sunderland Football Club message boards. These are not people who are interested in politics, but gammon has cut through and is used in those forums as well. It's not by you, I hope, Alan. Absolutely not, of course. I mean, I would never describe anyone
if you mix the colours of Sunderland Football Club.
You do get gammon.
Anyway, so moving swiftly on to... Well, actually, Alan, why don't you start part one of the two-part case for backstop as well.
Well, I mean, it's just tremendously po-faced now, though, isn't it, to say backstop? But it is, if you are serious about politics, and I do try sometimes, undoubtedly, the word of the year in terms of just, you know, the import of the policy debate. But also, it is the one word where I've genuinely... I mean, anyone who uses the word contingency plan or insurance policy, generally, that's just gone. It's just every time we have a conversation now, I feel people replacing those words with the word backstop. It does seem to be sort of perlicating through kind of...
I think maybe the word should be fallback, though. All along, it should have been fallback, because backstop is a position in baseball.
Rounders as well.
Rounders two, come on.
I never thought when I was playing rounds at school that the word rounders. Backstop would come to dominate everything ever again.
Yeah, exactly.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah, so Madeline, you've also planned for backstop.
Well, yes, just because it has become the key sticking point in our negotiations. Everything leads back to the Irish border. It's been kind of weaponized by both sides. And it's something that I don't think many politicians or many policy wonks fully understand. It's hugely complicated. It tends to confuse people. And that's partly why it's holding up negotiations so effectively, because both sides are kind of making bold claims about what they know of the black backstop.
Yeah. No, it is extraordinary.
This
that
reminds me of
an
the
insurance
conversation.
Policy, yeah. Which nobody wants to see, has managed to stymie the negotiation.
I mean, this is So I put a different word as my word of the year, which was managed, as in managed no deal. But I am just going to swing behind backstop straight away, because I do think if you want to look at Brexit as a story. The big story in the 2018 chapter of that rip roaring novel is Ireland becoming the thing through which everything flows, because obviously of course it was the December agreement last year where that was the seeds were laid for seeds were planted for what has been the sort of decisive issue.
I guess the question is why any of us were surprised by that. I mean, it is the most intractable question in the history of British politics. We really should have been a bit more across it during the referendum.
I think they should have started to explore alternative options. They've only just now started, very recently, started talking to the customs experts and so on. They haven't sent, took them a very long time to send civil servants out to Switzerland to see how the border's functioning there. All of this border stuff, they left until the very last minute. And we've yet to hear that the technology could not be up and running within the few years. I mean, it's obviously, it may not be there right now, but no one has said this could never be a workable solution whatsoever, and yet the Irish border is still holding up negotiations.
That's an argument for voting for the deal rather than anything else, because, I mean, that's the future of the relationship.
One of the paradoxes of this is if you're a anti-deal Brexiteer, you are presumably confident that there is a solution to this Irish border. It should follow that you should be comparatively relaxed about the backstop, because it'll be so blindingly obvious that there are alternative solutions. So, you know, what do you have to worry about? That said, I sort of feel like I've repeated this ad nauseum on CapEx, but it's not, you know, the backstops, given that the backstop was designed to ensure peace and stability in Northern Ireland, it's not exactly got, its track record so far is not exactly brilliant, is it? So, you know, is this becoming this sort of crazy self-defeating insurance policy where it makes the thing it's supposed to insure against more likely, and then weirdly makes people sort of double down on it in this kind of nightmarish...
Yes, exactly. But I think surely the key problem with the backstop as we currently have it enshrined in the withdrawal bill is the fact that the EU that has the unilateral right to veto it. So we could be locked into it in perpetuity. Isn't that the problem we're looking at here, that we say we could get out of it at some point, but where's the guarantee that would happen?
Yeah, that is obviously the big... Yeah, I can't argue with the fact that that is the big problem with it.
But it wouldn't be a backstop without that element. That's the goal. Yeah.
But I think the fact that here we are, you know, rowing about the backstop just sort of proves that backstop is word of the year.
It should be in the sense that also it just didn't exist before this year in any sense. So it's like a complete 2018 neologism.
So we are officially crowning backstop the word of the year 2018.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Okay, so our next category is Idea of the Year. This is where we try and get, you know, kind of very serious, policy-minded and highbrow about things. Or maybe not, we'll see. Okay, so let's kick off with Madeline.
Okay, so the idea I've gone for is, I guess much like my choice of Theresa May, it's not necessarily an idea that I agree with, but it was an idea that was announced in the Labour Party manifesto that would basically force companies of more than 250 employees to essentially hand over 10% of their equity to their workers. Now, this policy, to me, the reason I've chosen it is that I think it's a classic example of the kind of really important conversations that we're not having as a result of Brexit. You know, this is a lunatic Maoist idea, the kind that you'd get in a
kind
of force it, like it's expropriation.
Please get off the fence,
expropriation, right? It's the kind of thing that happens in banana republics, and it's being proposed by a mainstream party that a large company can simply, you know, take away 10% of the shares from their shareholders, which is their property, and just redistribute it amongst the workforce. This is super authoritarian, and no one has. I've barely read an article about it. This is why I picked it, because I think it's this is a product of the Brexit black hole of policy that we've seen spring up in the last 2 years.
Should okay. CapEx more, loads.
Yeah, we really went to town on John McDonald's.
Glad to hear it.
Alan, what's your idea of the year?
Well, you know, I'm going to be po-faced and bat for the left here, but there's been quite an unbelievable level of interest in the more enlightened and thoughtful factions within the sort of McDonald Corbyn project around an idea which has been particularly popularised in Preston Council called community wealth building. It's more a sort of place-based policy toolkit, really, and I don't agree with all of it. I mean, just to run through it, a lot of it is kind of about trying to increase the amount of purchasing power, through purchasing power and procurement, increase the amount of wealth that stays within a certain local area. So, the usual criticisms of protectionism there. But it is the first policy, really, that the first sort of philosophy really I've seen that I think is asking the right question after Brexit, which is how do we generate endogenous sort of growth in some of the poorer communities. We went through 13 years with New Labour where central state expansion and redistribution was not enough to give towns like Preston and Grimsby a dignified role in a competitive global economy. And actually one of my criticisms of Corbynism is, to a certain extent, when you strip it all away, it's just Blairism on steroids. It's just the same top-down central state expansion and a redistribution with a little bit of extra nationalisation and rail train kits to play with. So, you know, it's asking the right questions and I think there's a seed of an idea there, which, I mean, I think it's slightly oversold, actually. I don't think it's as protectionist as people make out. But if you are interested in things like infant industry, you know, sort of infant industry theory, which suggests that most countries at the start of their development start off as a little bit of protectionist before they eventually, at a beneficial moment, swing behind free trade. Is it really sensible that something like the single market, which is a huge trade liberalisation project, applies in all areas equally? And are they not politically sensitive and, you know, in a normal, you know, politically sensitive and poor areas of Europe, which perhaps could have a slightly different policy framework, which would be beneficial for them in the short term before they get back on their feet. So I think there's an interesting idea within there.
And so you think that's, I mean, it's idea of the year in the sense that it's an answer to, I mean, not one, you know, I'm not saying I agree with it or anything, but it's an answer to what you think is the big question,
how you create sustainable wealth creation in poor communities themselves, indigenous, rather than, you know, just handing out some money from the central state or for the EU, which as we have seen in the Welsh Valleys, fantastic appreciation for all the money they've received from the EU does not necessarily confer dignity on an area.
Okay, so from CWB to BDS, John, your idea of the year.
BDS stands for Brexit Derangement Syndrome, and we've seen this. This doesn't apply uniquely to leavers or remainers. I think anyone who spends any time, it is a particularly prevalent phenomenon on Twitter, which I spent probably too much time on and have recently discovered the joys of the mute button. I'll avoid naming too many names, but I think we all know who the people are who, day in, day out, every single thing they tweet is about Brexit, but they're not news reporters reporting about it. But it's not just that. It's not just the obsession with Brexit. It's the fact that everything to do with it is either triumph or disaster, and never the twain shall meet.
Right.
And I think we've got to this stage where... And another element of BDS is that people just take it, politicians' words on their side at complete face value, as if it's just fine. Like, so everything that emanates from the EU is taken by Remainers as just, like, sacrosanct. And almost the likes of Donald Tusk and Jean-Claude Juncker are treated as though they're kind of sages rather than transactional politicians. By the same token, on the kind of hard Brexity wing of things, there is, we discussed the unicorns earlier, this just ludicrous idea that you can just shun the detail and just go with a bit more Peter Pan politics, you could call it.
Yeah.
If you just believe a bit harder.
The core of BDS, though, isn't it about the way in which...
It's obsession. It's those guys outside Parliament now.
But it's also conspiracy theory stuff. I mean, you see on Twitter, basically, sensible sort of... people who, a few years ago, were just incredibly boring people more than anything else, going in for the most bonkers idea about some specific flight some Russian took from here to here. And
the document BBC vicar, perfect example of BDS.
Yeah, exactly.
So some random person who was an extra in a TV programme goes on Newsnight and to make the case for leave or something.
She was part of
the BBC have got hired an actor to make the leave case.
It's all a bit. Yeah.
No one in their right mind would put her on the case for your side.
Do we think BDS is a 2018 phenomenon? Or
it has ramped up this year. It's all got a bit. And I think, you know, people were obviously partisan and sort of slightly deranged about Brexit last year, but the conspiracy theories has really added an element this year. It's all gone a bit Adam Curtis, where it's a sort of, you know, this thing happened,
this thing happened,
and you do not see the sun and the moon in the same sky together. Now think about it.
And crazy sort of flowcharts of all going.
And somehow, if we don't think in this kind of loony flowcharty way, then we're the ones who haven't been paying attention.
Yeah.
We the people who, you know, have been attempting to follow along the arguments.
Sheeple.
Wake
up. Okay, so we've got.
And actually, I would say that as anyone who's ever worked, I don't know if any of you guys have ever worked for a politician or anything.
Thankfully, I haven't.
Thankfully, not. But it's very, you know, it's in the loop. It's very the thick of it style thing. And what you realise very quickly is that generally the most likely explanation is incompetence. Yeah, but people who are a bit far removed think that the forces controlling their lives are all sinister and somehow linked.
My idea of the year, I think, is techlash, which is the horrible new word.
Sounds like something Elon Musk would do.
Both of yours sounded really kinky.
it's a word I've chosen to sum up to stand in for the kind of the backlash against big tech companies and the way in which I think 2018 has been the year in which Facebook, most spectacularly, but in general, big tech is something which not just columnists and newspapers and policy dogs and so on, but the wider public are really starting to think in a very different way about in several ways. Firstly, how they use technology, and secondly, the economic consequences of all of this, and what role these tech giants play in society. So, and I'm not as sort of freaked out as the average person about lots of these things, but I do just sort of sense that there has been a real change in mood. I mean, partly that's because you've had these terrible stories about the most recent being Facebook's pursuit of its critics in the sort of most kind of ghastly way imaginable over the last few years. But I really actually am talking about the broader social point of, I just wonder whether we'll look back on the last few years as this sort of mad period where we just rushed in and just did everything we possibly could online and like ticked every box and spent loads of time on social media. And I just feel like there's a sort of maturing of our attitude to all of these technologies.
It just made me think, actually, back to an earlier category, and I'm not trying to rerun the other awards, but that Mark Zuckerberg is a candidate for losing.
Yeah, yeah, actually, or Sheryl Sandberg.
He's had a terrible year.
He's had a really bad year.
Yeah. I think their share prices, I don't know what the figure is at the moment.
It's certainly lower than it was.
Definitely a lot lower, speaking from your investor, paradigm. I think,
He's hired Nick Clegg as well, which is interesting.
I mean, I'm going to have to kind of just host prerogative. I'm going to rule out community wealth building, I'm afraid, Alan, because it's deeply non-CapEx idea, firstly. And secondly, I think it's not... I feel like for idea of it has to be something in the zeitgeist in a way. Maybe it's in a particular zeitgeist.
You're missing an opportunity to commission at least 15 pieces against it next year.
Give us time. Give us time and we will. BDS is obviously very... I mean, anyone else have any views here? I'm sort of just weighing in all of them.
In terms of my John McDonald one, I've chosen it not so much for the idea itself, but more of what it embodies. Yeah. But if it's pure zeitgeist, it can probably be ruled out. But equally, I think what it speaks to is something really important where we're turning a blind eye.
I want to contest the John McDonald one, actually, because I thought that was a classic example of something that a lot of people have forgotten how to do, which is opposition politics, where you flag something... because that's how you get into The Guardian as a sort of think piece and everyone starts debating about it, which is ludicrous. And then at the same time, which he did, ring up all the businesses and say, yeah, we'll have a consultation on this. It's going to be a lot of different, So you kind of go radical. And this is exactly what you do at this time in the cycle. And, Ed Miliband didn't really work out how to do it. But you start from here and then you move in and bring people... into a bit more practical as you get closer to an election.
I do actually think another way in which that proposal was quite clever and actually typical of John McDonald's strength as a politician is he's very good at understanding the vocabulary of a world outside his own politics. Whereas Jeremy Corbyn is kind of just comfortable talking to kind of meetings of people who agree with him, and that's his whole kind of world. McDonald's very good, and one of the really interesting things about the share plan is, and lots of other things he proposes, it's actually couched in this like oddly like Thatcherite language of ownership and control and
communities.
And so I think it is, in that sense, it's also very instructive in terms. I mean, if you are opposed to the idea of John McDonald as a chancellor, it's a good example of completely flawed and bonkers idea.
Yeah,
cleverly
and that's
packaged.
That's why I think it's a really important argument because this is what will happen if those of us who care about free markets are not robustly making these points. Because someone who's not following the detail that closely will like the sound of it. It will sound, as you say, it will sound like something liberating, something that, something democratising for workers and so on. It will sound a bit like shares or Royal Mail shares or something, or like a cooperative or whatever, something much less threatening. But what it actually is forcible acquisition of private property and
just lots more tax, basically,
and also creating terrible incentives for business. Like, I think they've set up some other. I think they've got. They also floated the idea of forcing all companies with more than 250 people to publicly name any employee who's earning more than like 100 grand or 150 grand or something. So I think that those two things combined, they'll be creating an awful lot of companies that have 249 employees.
I think we can file that plan under one of my favourite phrases of the year, which is plausible bullshit. just sums up so many different things in politics where, like, you could hear it without having read much about it. Think, yeah.
But that, that's kind of my point because, you know, 18 months in...
Yeah, it speaks to your point completely.
Plausible
yeah.
bullshit is what you're meant to be coming up with as an opposition party. You're not meant to be running the country. The journey...
Because everyone will have forgotten the detailed stuff. But
into a costed and, you know, practical plan which you then can take to stakeholders, civil society.
I'm not willing to back the share planner's idea of the year, not least because Madeline's nominees have actually won all the other categories so far. So I feel like she can't be three
this.
You're
maybe I can defend.
I'm riding for Tech Lab.
I'm already 3-0.
Come on.
I think that I really do
BBS
think that.
It's not an idea, is it?
What?
Tech Lab.
No, I think
it's not an idea.
BDS
isn't really an idea so much as a phenomenon.
I agree. I think Tech Lash is very much an idea. It's we've been using social media quite unthinkingly for the last 10 years or so, and it's only recently that people have actually, and I find it remarkable that it's taken us this long to put two and two together, that there's this amazing product that you get for free and you didn't think that you were selling your data in order to acquire that product, you know. But people are starting to think about it more in those terms.
Put it this way, if someone explained that point to someone about data and why is it free and so on, if you explained that to someone sort of 18 months ago, I think that would be the sort of a new argument to lots of people, whereas now that's completely kind of appreciated by the average sort of moderately engaged punter.
Okay, and I'll spin for you, Ollie, as well. So, look, the other three ideas, let's be clear, are absolutely parochial. And if we're looking at things like the Gilets Jaunes, and if we're looking at things like the Rohingya communities and the travails in Myanmar, you know, social media has had a profound impact, and that's we've learned a lot more about that this year, about the sort of damaging impact it can have in countries where democracy is not as strong as it is here. So,
people are coming round to it.
I mean, it'll win by default because both of you want
to. You're listening to BDS, but I'm afraid, John, you're outvoted.
Although I did just say, I think if on reflection, BDS is not so much as an idea,
sounds like
as a phenomenon. It's a description.
It sounds like a disease. Yeah.
It's a disease.
It is a disease.
It's not an idea. It's the opposite of an idea.
I think if there was an idea we would most like, if there was one of these things on this list we'd most like to be rid of in 2019, I'm pretty sure BDS is top of everyone's list.
Because we spend a lot far too much time on Twitter, and we have to deal with these people on a regular basis. Some of us still follow Lord Adonis.
Okay, so but BDS has a strength, but Tech Lash it is. Idea of the year 2018 is Tech Lash.
Okay.
Okay.
On we march.
Okay, so the next category is Shock of the Year. A sort of truly eyeball popping moment for each of us over the last 12 months. Alan, why don't we start with you?
I think you should start with John, actually.
Okay, John.
Because I'm going to vigorously oppose his thing because I actually predicted England to be in the semi-finals of the World Cup.
Oh, well, there, you've taken that. You've shot his thunder.
Shot my fox there.
John, why was that?
Well,
such a
okay, shock? I might change it to not just England being in England getting to the semi-finals. Kieran Trippier, Man City youth reject and former Burnley right back in team Play of the World time. Cup. And just, I think, more seriously, the whole country just going completely nuts in a good way for about a month. It was awesome. And the glorious summer of 2018. You know,
was.
We all actually had fun and didn't hate each other for like 3 weeks. It was
and then we quit, and then you know, business as
then
usual
we got back
quickly
to
resumed afterwards.
You might have, Alan may have sage-like qualities of football prediction, but I don't think anyone else in the country thought we'd get to the semis.
I think before the tournament, on record.
I think part of the reason it was so enjoyable was because it was such a surprise. I mean, it wasn't like one of those like, you know, there's expectation laden England tournaments where it's like anything other than thrashing a rubbish team 5-0 is seen as like an absolute nightmare. And, you know, we were just sort of riding with it and seeing where it went. And
I think we're so used to doing ourselves down.
Yes, and it's almost become a national pastime in itself.
And I will go as so far as to predict that England will win a major tournament in the next 14 years. So you can
14?
Okay, well, we'll mark that then.
Yeah, if not more than one.
Okay, Alan, what's your own?
Well, my real World Cup shock because it has never happened, whereas England have reached the semi-finals at least twice before and was predicted by some sage-like amateur football pundits, is the fact that Germany have never been knocked out in the group stage. It's never happened before. And there was this wonderful... I work in a shared office. There was this wonderful moment where I was watching the South Korea game surreptitiously, and when South Korea scored with about 10 minutes to go, about 50% of the office just went, yes! jumped up. It was a remarkable moment to see, and you know, Schadenfreude is a wonderful thing. But yeah, it's more seriously, I think, and I was sort of maybe expecting it to win, but the scale, and one of the more positive things, political stories here, that the scale of the victory for repeal of the Eighth and the extension of abortion rights to women in Ireland kind of shocked me how big the margin of victory was. And you know, you're used to reading about and learning about Ireland as this country that's completely suffused with Catholicism, and it's brought, you know, plenty of problems with that over the centuries. So I think it was really quite a wonderful moment in Irish politics, and it was a shock to me that a country can transform itself overnight so quickly.
Yeah. What was the margin, actually? Do you happen to know? I mean, I remember it was something extraordinary.
Bigger than I expected. Yeah. I think it was over 10%, I think.
Yeah.
Which, in a two-horse race, is quite big.
And given the narrative that we are told about Ireland, you know, the fact that you watch a documentary like the Magdalene Sisters or something, and the last thing they tell you is, this persisted until 1996 or whatever, the implication being Ireland is still this incredibly backwards place where people have these regressive views towards women. And for it to be so decisive in that way was, yeah, I agree, a real shock.
But Madeline, what was your own nomination? Although you sound quite tempted by Ireland's one, but
well, I'd completely forgotten that happened. I think it's probably the Brexit black hole again. But yeah, I've gone for the extraordinary optics of Donald Trump shaking hands with Kim Jong Un over the summer, because given the situation that we were in before that time, where North Korea had been busy firing rockets over Japan, and the language on Donald Trump's Twitter feed and the rhetoric elsewhere had been becoming increasingly belligerent, for it to culminate in a handshake was something quite extraordinary. And you know, I think obviously it remains to be seen if it was just a kind of spectacular optical thing or if it's something more meaningful, but either way, I think the extraordinary unprecedented moment that represented is I think extremely significant.
Okay, well, I'm going to kind of really only introduce this one slightly as a joke, because I think Madeline and Alan have both made persuasive cases for theirs. But Andy,
another great round for John.
we're recording this on the Wednesday before Christmas, and we are just, you know, the dust has barely settled on Jeremy Corbyn, stupid woman gate. And my big shock was seeing on Twitter that Hollywood actor Rob Lowe weighed in and said he was watching PMQs on Sky News and he saw Jeremy Corbyn utter the word stupid woman. So just the fact that Rob Lowe watches PMQs on Sky News is my kind of... I mean, is it shock of the year? It's certainly shock of the week.
I don't know who Rob Lowe is.
Rob Lowe
he's the
speechwriter in The West Wing. Sam Seaborn is here, and he's
just a lot of stuff.
He's a very famous actor, isn't he?
I find he's in the Flintstones.
I know that's Colin.
I know the guy.
Okay, so but I'm willing to sort of park that as just a fun, you know, we'll forget about that by Christmas Day.
When I saw that today.
But I was genuinely shocked.
I'm always shocked when people... So there's a whole... I'm not one of them. I find it hard enough to keep up with Westminster politics. But there's a very large group of people in this country who are obsessed with American politics, and they step to watch midterms, and they can tell you about the significance of each new seat or whatever. I can never imagine Americans doing the same thing to us. So I can never imagine people in New York staying up till 4 to be like, the Coventry District Council has declared, you know.
I did see actually it was quite funny. I think that CNN broadcast PMQs. I think it was the day when the day of the confidence vote. So last week was that. And I did see lots of people quipping on Twitter that you know, this was an example of global Britain in action, that we must be doing something right because PMQs is on CNN.
I think PMQs has got quite an audience in Japan, I think.
Japan.
It's like a kind of slightly...
Well, it's like a kind of Takeshi's Castle style weekly show.
Exactly.
I think PMQs plays into a certain type of Americans... image of what England is like. Yes. Just like ridiculous posh people shouting at each
John
Burkley
is like this.
Ornamental, like Latin crap.
Well, but we'll take Rob Lowe out of the running, sadly. I would say, Madeline, if I was going to push back against the Trump thing, I would say maybe these days, like, nothing could shock me with Trump. and he does sort of favour the kind of shallow but big gesture.
Yes.
In that sense, I kind of was. You're right, it was extremely striking, but it sort of just felt like that was how it was going to end in a funny kind of way.
Yes. I do take that point, but the fact is that prior to that meeting, they're busy firing rockets left, right, and centre, and they've not since doing that, and they're engaging more in the international community. Now, I'm not a geopolitical expert, but that to me is a pretty momentous change that has been realised, albeit through, you know, self-serving means. The end result is still pretty important.
I think if you'd on January the 1st of this year, if you'd been like, Donald Trump is going to meet Kim Jong-un in a hotel in Singapore.
No, if you wanted to be really shocked.
And England are going to get to the semi-finals of the World Cup.
If you wanted to be in January, you would definitely have some question marks. The Germany one is definitely the weirdest.
If you wanted to be really shocked, you should have told someone the Trump thing in like 2050. Then
it's not just about the meeting that he had, the shaking of hands. It's about the weird stuff that came out in the aftermath as well. Do you remember when he said, I fell in love with him?
Yes.
And he sent me beautiful letters. You know, Kim Jong-un the poet, Trump, wherefore art thou, etc.
Yeah, Trump's fawning over various dictators is one of the most depressing things about him.
In a long list.
Yeah.
His Putin meeting was pretty extraordinary as well.
Yes.
So I believe him.
Seems like a great guy.
Yeah.
I'm not feeling the semi-finals one.
You were saying in the summer.
I don't know. I would say either Ireland or Trump gets my vote. But
I'm gonna vote for Trump.
Okay, so we've got two for Trump. Okay, I'll go for Trump as well. Sorry, Alan.
Oh, thanks.
So that means shock of the year is the remarkable sight of Donald Trump shaking hands with Kim Jong Un. Okay, so the final round is cameo of the year. Is another going to be another hotly contested category. And why don't we kick things off with Alan, who refused to start last time, so you have to start this time.
I'm going to go with... I mean, look, as we've all discussed so far, we spend too much time on Twitter. And when you're sort of travailing through some of the bottom of the barrel of Twitter, you encounter some people who are, quite frankly, unbelievable. And so my cameo of the year is Craig Murray, who must be the conspiracy theorist's conspiracy theorist, who at some point in the admittedly very tragic Salisbury scandal decided to put forward the line that obviously the UK's line was nonsense, and the most obvious explanation is that the most likely explanation is these were just gay Russian bodybuilders, these just gay Russian lovers who are probably a bit interested in the dodgy end of the bodybuilding industry. Like, most likely, this is most likely. It was possibly...
Explain who Craig Murray is for those fortunate enough not to have heard of him.
Craig Murray is what used to be called in the Cold War a useful idiot, in that he basically regurgitates the most ludicrous pro-Russian RT Sputnik lines available. Not just the ones that are slightly plausible, the absolutely ridiculous ones. For example, that these are obviously, most likely explanation, just some gay Russian bodybuilders.
Well, so didn't
who happen to have a real affinity for the town of Salisbury in February or January, whenever it was.
Wasn't he also showing up sort of pick passport photos plus the CCTV of these people?
Look, he was involved in all of this. It was a two month binge on just nonsense that, you know, he was putting forward. He was at the heart of all of it. Yeah, and definitely don't look him up on Twitter because it's insane. But yeah, that was my cameo of the year. My favourite Twitter idiot of the year, really.
Well, that leads us neatly onto my my nomination for cameo of the year. Here's a man called Steve Bray. You probably don't know the name Steve Bray, but you've almost certainly, if you work in Westminster, you know who he is. If you watch the news for more than 5 minutes in the last few weeks, you know who he is, because he is the extremely loud Stop Brexit protester who marches forwards and backwards behind behind the cameras on College Green, and much to the annoyance of all the hosts and all the journalists trying to do their jobs there. I am no fan of Steve Bray, but he has been one of the sort of more unlikely figures to have just been sort of looming in the background,
yeah,
like a good cameo throughout this year, depressingly.
I'm starting to wonder if it might actually not be a political protest. It might actually be some kind of modern art installation or like a Hitchcock-style, you know, artistic point that he's making. I doubt it, but...
Well, so Steve Bray, it was a sort of very lonely vigil for a long time, and now as we get closer to the Brexit kind of endgame, he's now...
I'm gonna push against this because, and this will go to the approximately two Labour conference attending listeners of this podcast, but Steve Bray is but a child to the legend of Labour Party conferences, which is the no nukes guy with his bulldog, who in 2012, I think it was, it might have been 13, managed to end up having a actual brawl with Ian Dale and Damien McBride on Brighton Pier. And the best bit of it all is so Ian Dale and this protester are sort of wrestling on the ground, but his long-suffering dog, who has been carried from Labour conference for year to year, dressed as an anti-trident artifact, turns on his owner. He doesn't go for Ian Dale, he goes directly for his owner. It's like, yes, this is my chance. So, for me, Steve Bray has many echelons.
Maybe
in this
he
kind
needs
of
a dog. We need to stop
Brexit.
We need to stop Steve Bray dog. Maybe don't keep that in there.
Okay, so, Madeline, your cameo of the year.
Well, okay, so I picked two, but I have a feeling that I may be clashing with somebody else. So I'm just going to go for the one that was unique to me. So we're going to hear from John about Geoffrey Cox, the Attorney General who stole the show at the Conservative Party conference. Now, my pick is someone else who stole the show at the final hour, and that is Cher's performance in Mamma Mia 2. Now, I don't know who is listening to this podcast. I suspect maybe slightly blokier than girlier.
Absolutely not.
But if you got dragged to see it with a partner or mother, then you'll know that Cher turns up within the last 15 minutes and just completely kills it with three amazing songs. And then, you know, it's Cher, for God's sake. She dominates. So that's my cameo of the year.
Okay. I mean, as someone who hasn't seen Mamma Mia 2, I... find it hard to kind of...
One?
You know who Cher is, right?
I know, of course I know who Cher is.
She dominates everything.
Or ABBA.
Oh, I've heard of ABBA.
It's a very ABBA year, so that's quite a...
Well, exactly. And John, your cameo of the year is...
Mine was... Because I'd honestly forgotten he was even an MP.
Let alone in the cabinet.
Let alone in the cabinet. Geoffrey Cox, who... came on to do a kind of warm-up for the PM, which is usually a fairly, bit of a formality.
And this is that Conservative Party conference.
I'd never heard him speak before, which, given that I used to work for a website where I watched Parliament for, like, hours every day, really is saying something. And he comes out and he's kind of like the sort of love child of Brian Blessed and Winston Churchill. It's extraordinary. But I think the best bit, I've actually brought the quote up, where he starts quoting Milton about Brexit and says, "Methinks I see in my mind a noble and puissant nation." And I think that's the moment when we kind of really knew that Britain had gone mad.
I was going to say, you've got Brexit deranged.
Hey, Milton is still relevant.
Yeah, I think that was...
The faithful in the audience are probably lapping it up. I just thought it was, like, kind of ludicrous. Like,
I mean, I guess if...
It was a good performance, but, like...
You picked him and you don't love him as we do.
Yeah, Madden's okay, got angry. Deserves she had to argue for sure.
He deserves Cameron the other year because no one had ever heard of him and now people have.
I think the argument against Jeffrey Cox's cameo of the year would actually be that sort of that he's a victim of his own success and he's more than a cameo and he's now
the cameo of the year.
But yeah, oh, you mean the exact
that 10 minutes? Yeah, Jeffrey Cox.
But the crazy world we live in includes, you know, is one in which people sort of vaguely toss his name up as a sort of caretaker prime minister in the near future. And
but he's I think he is in contempt of parliament at the moment as well. I mean, that's,
yeah, on the legal.
He's
side.
Had quite a year.
He's had quite a three months.
Quite an autumn.
Yes, but you're right because even though as he clearly made some strategic errors when it came to the publication of the legal advice on Brexit, he had to embarrassingly U-turn after two days, I think, and was held in contempt of Parliament. Despite that, he will always be the guy with the Aslan voice, won't he? So on the one hand, he's kind of beyond normal criticism, in much the same way that Jacob Rees-Mogg often manages to avoid it because of his kind of eccentricities. And it also, on the flip side, means that people don't quite give him, you know, take him as seriously as perhaps they should. You know, it was announced today in the Times, I think, that he was, you know, he's militating against Theresa May and he's discussing, you know, we're going to wait until, you know, early next year and then we'll depose her. So he's on manoeuvres, but no one cares because they're just talking about the Brian Blessed accent.
But I think also, you did nominate him, but I think you're being a bit unfair on him in the sense that it was a real change of tone from the average political speech, but I mean, it was great. It was authentic. These sentences actually were so much better constructed and actually meant something in a way that lots of political speeches, you know, don't. There's a pointless triangulation.
I just meant
stuff.
The Milton thing. The Milton thing is.
It was a bit like,
what's he doing?
Well, and also, let's not forget the exact sequence of events is mystery person to warm up for the Prime Minister. The mystery person is Jeffrey Cox, the cabinet minister everyone forgot about. Turns out he has this great voice. Then he quotes Milton. Then, seconds later, Dancing Queen by ABBA comes on and Theresa May dances onto the stage. So it was a completely sort of balmy few minutes.
Yeah.
It was very sort of dead catty, if you think about it. Everyone forgot that she didn't mention Brexit.
I think Jeffrey Cox really struck a chord with people. I agree with Ollie in a more meaningful way than just they enjoyed hearing his voice, to be fair. I think he represents quite a dying breed of politician, which was the kind of the lawyer politician. We don't have as many of those. And everything about him, I think, gives off a sense of security. He's kind of seems distinguished. He knows his brief. He's got this kind of rotund charmingness about him. And all of this is, you don't actually get too much of it in politics these days. We've had years of careerist type politicians who've been a spad, then become a politician. And it's quite nice to have a senior politician who's been on the bar for 36 years. It's reassuring.
Okay, so a rock in these turbulent times.
Can I make
Jeffrey
a case
Cox?
Then for my own nomination here? Because
I think
mine
saying.
Is
in
the only one. Yeah,
I think
well,
you need to
mine
one.
And Mads are the only ones that are actually cameos.
Well, I really hope Craig. I really hope Craig Murray's a cameo.
And Steve,
if he comes back,
Craig Murray is just a long sort of.
Yeah, that's true, Ollie. That's a very good point. I mean, the cameo is meant to be just one scene.
Yeah, not
Steve
like
Gray is
not
perennial.
Like the backdrop in a movie versus the cameo in the movie. Okay, so for that reason, I'll.
Well, in which case, surely that's an argument for,
I need
for ruling
at least
Jeffrey.
One victory.
But surely that's a case for ruling Jeffrey Cox out. Because no, I rather suspect that Jeffrey Cox's story is not yet.
We'll just put
written.
At Tory conference after.
No,
Jeffrey Cox.
I think Jeffrey Cox is like it's one of those cameos where he was such a popular cameo in the first movie that there's like going to be a whole spin-off series
yes.
in which
yeah.
Jeffrey Cox
yes.
is the main character.
Britney Spears in 10 Things I Hate About You.
Yeah. Okay. So we're gonna call it Jeffrey Cox wins cameo of the year. From CapEx, and this is the last CapEx podcast of the year. Have a great Christmas. Have a happy New Year. And we to play us out. We bring you the dulcet tones of Jeffrey Cox.
Methinks I see in my mind a noble and puissant nation. Rousing herself like a strong man after sleep, and shaking her invincible locks. Methinks I see her as an eagle, mewing her mighty youth, and kindling her undazzled eyes at the full midday beam. Ladies and gentlemen, let us seize that prize. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.